on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 94-year-old ex-prisoner of war Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico. When we left off, Bill was saying that he got his hands on a book, and there weren't too many books around this Japanese prison camp. It sounds like pretty dry subject matter. It was a book on all the rules of bridge, the card game. But Bill, it sounds like it wasn't about what was in the book, but the opportunity for that book to keep your mind stimulated. Is that right?
I got that book, and I started memorizing. The diet was so bad that we were worried that our minds were going bad, too. And maybe we were justified. We didn't know. But I started memorizing 30 minutes to walk and 30 minutes back, and I memorized that whole book.
Wow.
We played bridge with the Portuguese subjects, British subjects, bank tellers. Mm-hmm. That's what they did. We didn't stand a chance because we used the same system that the book was, and they used the eclectic system. They made it up on their own, and they'd say three clubs, and the partner say four diamonds and five no trump, and they'd bid it and make it, and we kept a perpetual score, and we got 10,000 points behind, but we still played. We loved it.
Well, it kept your minds going, huh?
We would get a chance to shower, and they had these little wooden bins about like this, oval shape, with fresh water in them, and we would pour one of those over us and then soap up, and then we'd take another one and pour over to wash the soap off. Then we would go get into a hot tub. It was a hot tub with walls about this high, and it was about this big around, circular. And it had a pipe in it and a steam. It would go tick, 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 tick. And that pipe would heat that water. Hmm. They'd heat it almost boiling hot. Man. It was so darn hot that sometimes you'd hesitate to getting in. Hmm. We loved it. If your turn was early, you got into that, it was clean water. If it was number 300, you got into soup. It was the dirtiest looking stuff you ever saw. These other guys, instead of washing with soap and water, they'd say, well, I can't wait. They'd get in. And they'd get the wash off in the steam water. The food was bad, bad, bad. We had three meals a day. We had grain. First of all, we had wheat, and they'd make biscuits. And, we loved those. But they didn't last more than a couple of months. And then we were on rice. Used rice, white rice. Barley, Korea. We called it Korea. It was a reddish colored grain, and we didn't know what it was, and soybeans, and that was it. We didn't know what it was. It was keeping us alive, but everybody met the diet, unless you worked in the kitchen or something like that, and you got all you wanted. And we never got that. We had two meals a day, the breakfast and supper. And it was that grain, and that's all it was.
And not large quantities, I'm sure.
Oh, no. Everybody got the same ration. We had one man that was captured late in camp, and he was a subject from Ireland, and one of the naval companies. He was captured on a naval ship, and he had the best build on him, just like a bodybuilder today that you have seen. Man, he looked beautiful. In 6 months, he was dead. He couldn't adjust to that diet. Mm-hmm. And it was a case of adjusting. I got down to 60 kilos or even less, which is 132 pounds. But I had not lost the weight that, say, a six-footer or anybody that weighed over that weight, you know. Either you adjust or you don't. But we had many diseases. Beriberi was one of them. Pellagra was another. And a lot of guys had malaria. And it was just unbelievable. We got out to the shipyard. We got lunch out there. Have you ever eaten fish head soup?
No, I've heard about it. Sounds delightful.
Well, it's not delightful, but you eat it. Eggs, eyes, and all. Mm-hmm. When you're out there and you're hungry. And we found out later, indirectly, that the native people were not eating any better than we were. Mm. But we knew the guards were eating better than we were, because they would not eat anything but white rice. Mm. They wouldn't eat soybeans and any of the rest. Soybeans are what kept us alive. The protein from those soybeans kept us alive. We didn't know it. Most of us didn't even have any ideas, but that's what did. But we were hungry all the time. And we lived thinking about what we were going to eat when we got home. It just, you cannot believe some of the menus that these guys came up with and wrote them out.
I've had POWs tell me that before. The imaginary restaurants they were going to eat at. For you, it must have been, what would it have been, green chili or red chili you were craving?
No. Ice cream and cake and all that. Desserts, and I still love them, boy.
I bet you do. Did your family have any idea what had become of you? Did they know you were a POW?
Eventually. I finally got a letter from my aunt, who was a farmer back in Illinois, and she wrote a letter. It was just like, you can't believe. Hope from home. And we got a Red Cross parcel when we were in camp. We got I think we got 2.5 Red Cross parcels in 3 years. We looked forward to those parcels. You can't believe how we relished those things.
And the Japanese actually gave you everything that was in it?
Yes, the whole thing. That was unbelievable. I've heard stories about otherwise. But finally, I got a parcel from home. In the camp, it's a case of existence in another city or town or whatever. We had officers in the camp that made the rules. They didn't have to go to work. We were jealous of that. But we had guys that would trade their food off for cigarettes. Cigarettes was a mode of money.
Currency, yeah.
Currency. He had such an appetite for smoking that he would give up. Well, finally, the officers declared him bankrupt, and no longer could you trade cigarettes for his rice. And he finally started eating again. I guess he survived. But towards the end, we started getting a little ration of fish. We got whale meat. My first experience with a mammal, ocean going. And shrimp. We got shrimp and crab meat and stuff like that. Some of it was pretty darn good. We looked forward to it. And we even got some fruit, finally. We had some fruit. We didn't know what it was. They had their own name. And I still don't know. It's a cross between an apple and a pear or something like that. But we ate it. Boy, we'd eat anything we could get. Anything. There were no dogs. There were no cats. There were no anything around that was edible. We ate it.
I believe it. I know it's hard to answer some of these questions I ask in situations like this, but the thing that strikes me is when you're in that situation and you have no idea what the expiration date is, you have no idea when this war is going to be over, no idea whether you'll survive this prison camp, die in captivity. How did you remain hopeful? How did you continue to believe that you would be a free man again someday, that you'd get back to America someday? What was it that kept you going and kept you believing?
There was a Japanese newspaper, and I don't know where it came from. Working at a shipyard, it had sources that I was not aware of. I never did learn. Some guys brought in pure alcohol in their pants leg in a jar and drank alcohol and got drunk. I never got any of it. Anyway, we had a couple of guys in the camp that could read a Japanese newspaper. The Japanese newspaper had three languages. It had one called katagana, and one hiragana, and then kanji. Mm-hmm. The kanji part was the Chinese hen-scratching, we called it. And if you could read that, the katagana and the hiragana had something like 28 or 38 characters in it. It was like our alphabet, only right. longer. And then put that together with the kanji, and you could read it. But we had difficulty locating the maps on the paper where the activity, the war, was going on. But we also relied on rumors and scuttlebutt and everything else. But one day, a flight of bombers, American bombers, they weren't B-17s. They were B-29s. We had never seen a plane that big. Mm-hmm. It was as big as to carry, I think the capacity was something like five times bigger than a B-17.
Well, and when you went overseas, B-17 was the biggest thing flying. They hadn't even really been making B-24s yet, let alone B-29s.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And all they did was drop propaganda. And we saw some of it. And the Japs, they didn't like it. They didn't want us to read that stuff. And we still got some. But that's hope. Boy, when you're seeing those planes up there, mm-hmm. they're coming over and they're going back home. They're not getting shot down. One night we spent, later on, a night in the slit trenches again. And 400 of those babies came over. 400 B-29s. Now, Fujiyama is off to the west of Yokohama. Mm-hmm. And we see it every day on a clear day. Snow on it, beautiful. Peak Mountain.
We've all seen that beautiful mountain, sure.
The planes came in at night over Fujiyama and made a 90 over our camp and went over Tokyo and dropped gasoline bombs. And the searchlights were hitting each one of those planes. They were single file, and they're only about 1,000 yards. They were not up high. Mm-hmm. And we said, uh-oh, they're going to get it from the anti-aircraft. They're going to get it from the Zeros. Well, the Zeros, two Zeros would take the first one. He'd knock off the tail gunner, and then the other guy would sit back there and pump lead in until the tanks caught on fire. And then we'd see the plane start slipping away from the fire, and they'd get out over the ocean. We knew. We saw seven of them. I saw seven of them. They were on fire, and they never got home, and I doubt if they ever made it, because they fell in the ocean, and who's going to pick them up that close to Japan? Anyway, Zeros would take the first plane, and anti-aircraft would take the second one, and the Zeros would take the third one, and so forth. I said, well, why don't our planes shoot back? They've got machine guns in those B-29s. We never did see any machine gun. Oh, yeah, there's one. There he's shooting back. His tracers were a real bright red, and the Japanese were a dark red, so we could tell the difference. Mm-hmm. But we found out later that they scuttled all of those planes so they could put more bombs in and load the bombs. When we left, we knew that the Japs knew that they were going to hit Yokohama shipyard. And the last 6 months, they moved us north to Sendai. And we saw Tokyo. And it's just like this table.
Flattened.
Just like this table. Mm-hmm. Paper houses, wooden houses. There was one church, had a chimney sticking up, but it was masonry. Mm-hmm. And it could take it. But they dropped these bombs. And then they'd bring one plane in with HE, and it would take those fires and blow them a city block. Mm-hmm. And it was the most effective thing you ever saw. And we knew things were coming to an end.
Well, and I want to hear about that, but it's time for our final break. We'll get the final chapter of Bill Overmeyer's extraordinary story, including what it felt like after 1,227 days in captivity to become a free man again. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.